So let's make a start. We're expecting a few more people, but I'm sure they'll drift in as we're talking. So before we kick off today, I want to remember the land that I'm talking to you from. So I'm talking to you from Kaurna land today, the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. And I just want to really acknowledge the stewardship that those peoples have offered this land and this place over millennia. And I think this is particularly significant for us as a community of people because we are all concerned with the land, I think, and the people and the web of life that exists upon it that actually supports us. So to recognise the stewardship that elders past, present and future offer this land is something that's really important to me, and to feel our connection with the land that we are each on today too. Perhaps you might like to use the chat box just to recognise where you're speaking from to, where you're listening, participating from to. So today we're looking at particular change. Change from the perspective of generating a sustainable future. Something that the Aboriginal cultures did so beautifully. And I hope that today you come away with a few insights, maybe a little bit of inspiration, maybe identifying a couple of blind spots. We've all got them. And by identifying blind spots, we can actually generate new ways forward. So that can be really useful, I think. I would like to share with you about Sustainability Sounding Board, a new service that I'm committing to offer to people in your field, sustainability practitioners, to help support you through the coming decade. And we'll finish the session with 15 minutes of Q&A. There'll be time for maybe a question or two as we go through the session. However, I invite you to place any questions that you have into the chat box as we go. And I've got planned a bit of a reflection time in the middle of the session, so I'll have time to have a look at your questions and maybe respond to a couple as we go as well. So I hope you can all stay on for the full 75 minutes to get the advantage of actually being able to talk with each other as well. So the work I want to share with you today actually builds on the shoulders of giants in the field of systems thinking. People like Dana Meadows, who was the lead author for The Limits to Growth, a book that many of you would be familiar with. People like Peter Senge, who popularised systems thinking 30, 40 years ago now. Fritjof Capra, a physicist who's been working in the field of living systems for a very long time now, and wrote the Tao of Physics, a fabulous book. Nora Bateson, the daughter of Gregory Bateson, the son of William Bateson, a family with over 150 years of inquiry into living systems and how they operate. And Ron Heifetz from the School of Government at Harvard University, who I've worked with and learned from and with since 2006. So my work integrates thinking from these people, and I want to share just a snapshot of it with you today in the hope of achieving the things that we talked about earlier. So if change for sustainability is so much the right thing, why is it so difficult? And that question really has an assumption sitting underneath it, doesn't it, that it is difficult. So I've been talking with a few sustainability practitioners over the last couple of months as I've been researching for my fourth book, which will be about sustainability practitioners within organisations and the work that they're doing. And I've come to understand that not all sustainability practitioners actually feel a sense of angst. But nevertheless, the change has been difficult. We could interpret that as taking longer than we had hoped. It's certainly something that we've been aware of for 50 years or more. And sometimes it doesn't feel like we've made much progress. So, for example, just last year, the global carbon emissions were 6% higher. They reached, you know, never before reached levels of emissions. So it can make us feel a bit despondent at times. And my intention is not to amplify that, but look into why is this so difficult? And maybe in appreciating that it is actually difficult, we can take some of the stress off ourselves, and maybe we can also be more effective. So I want to start with a story. It's one of my stories, but I'm not telling it to boost my ego or in any way put myself on a pedestal, because I think this is actually our story. This is a story of people who come to work into this field, I think. And I want to use the story to illustrate the model that I want to share with you today. So back in 2003, I was talking with a guy called Sir John Whitmore at one of the first coaching conferences in Australia. And I had an epiphany. You know, one of those moments when the world stands still and everything changes. It's not ever going to go back to the way you saw it before. What I realised in that moment, as he was talking about and asked me a question around water supplies in the world, was that humanity was, you know, in that proverbial car with its foot flat to the floor on the accelerator and heading towards a cliff. And I still believe that that's a possibility. In that moment, things went clunk, clunk, clunk in my head. And I came out of that experience with a different perspective that changed the way that I operated in the world from there on in. And I think that that's an experience that many of us in this field have had. As a result of that, I changed my business completely. I was travelling almost on a weekly, sometimes two-weekly basis, on a plane over to the eastern states from Adelaide, where I live. And I realised that I needed to stop that. Not only was it tiring me enormously, but it was also, locking up an incredible carbon footprint. So I needed to stop that. I was doing it for the sake of ego. There were other people that could do that work that I was doing. I started looking at how I could earn a living in my own local area. So I was operating in the global sense, very aware of the global implications of my work, but working locally. And I think that's probably a fundamental principle many of us operate from too. I started to develop a new niche, and I became very aware of the clients that I was working with, and I chose to work with clients that were at the intersection of large systems in the area that I was working in. And I worked a lot with local councils, and it's great to see many of you from local councils here today. So I looked at how I was buying my business equipment, how I was employing people, all of those sorts of things, developed my own sustainability policy, and proceeded to operate. I started looking at home, and we organised renewable energy. We live in a semi-rural area, so tree planting, all of that sort of thing, caring for the land more, despite the fact that we had horses running on our land. How could we do both of those things better? We looked at our holidays, all of those sorts of things, and then started looking at car travel and how we could reduce the amount of emissions from that perspective and be more sustainable in terms of our travel. So we cut down the number of trips we make each day, each week. And then I started thinking I really need to get rid of that car. But we live in an area that doesn't have a public transport. And there's one bus that goes past our place morning and evening, comes all the way from Goolwa going up to Adelaide, and that's it. So it's a hell of a walk from here into Adelaide. So I got a bit stuck. And in that sense, I came up against the infrastructure limitations. So the first part of the story was about making personal changes. This little part of the story is about how I ran into the structures of the system. And I've still not been able to resolve that, because that has to do with planning. It has to do with also cultural assumptions that we have as a society that are then reflected in the way structures are created within our society. And so that's the model that I wanted to share with you, really, that the way we perceive the world is really important. And this is really simple, and it's been illustrated in the story that I was just telling you, that we have a systemic way of viewing the world as an option. And we can learn, we can practice this way of viewing the world. And I expect that on some level this is something that you already do, and this model may just make it more conscious, or maybe you're already familiar with something similar to this. So one way of thinking about the systemic perspective is that there is a personal element, a structural element, and a cultural element to absolutely everything we observe. So we could put change in the centre of this, we could put sustainability in the centre of this, we could put any topic we like. This is a way for understanding the different elements of that particular thing that we're observing. And I just want to talk through this and think about the change, the challenge of change for sustainability through this particular lens. And we'll just go through it one at a time. So when we think about change from the personal perspective, it becomes really interesting, because if we think about change within living systems, which is what we humans are, rather than robots, change is actually something that happens really naturally. It happens in response to changes in the environment around us. Or it can happen because we've had a neat new idea in an inspired moment through talking with someone else, or some ideas that click together in a slightly different way. And so the scientists call that a novelty, if you like, within the system. So both of those things can provoke changes within a system, or adaptations within a system. And I want to make it really clear that these are natural processes. They happen naturally. And what happens is that there might be a change out in the world around us, and we look at that information and we make sense of it. We might ask ourselves, with reference to what's important to us and our particular identity of ourselves, do I need to take notice of that or not? And do I need to change in response to it or not? And so this is a sense-making process that we humans go through when we are deciding whether to change. It's actually a process of learning. I first observed this when I was coaching people within an organisation. It was at the Defence Science and Technology Organisation so many years ago. And I was asked to coach a number of people, and there were a range of us coaching a number of people. And this coaching of a number of people was meant to change the organisational culture. Well, the coaching was going well, but there was nothing much happening in the organisational culture. And I started asking myself why, because I was watching the change unfolding in the people that I was working with, and yet it wasn't producing the desired outcome that we're looking for within the entire organisation. So one of the things that we can ponder, I think, is why is that so? And I'd like to suggest to you that it's because of the way we perceive the organisation. And so this goes into the more cultural aspects, the cultural assumptions that underpin the way we run our organisation. So I'm going to go there in a moment. Just let me fill a little gap between there and where we are now. So one of the ways that we go about change within organisations traditionally has used to use a top-down approach. Now, whether that's a scientist using their authority and telling us what we should do, or telling us information in ways that they hope we will make sense of but we seem to have trouble joining the dots between, oh, the temperature's going to go up 1.5 degrees and holy shit, I need to do things differently. Those dots don't get joined up very well in many scientific communications. But within organisations, someone in the senior hierarchy usually makes a decision that something needs to change and then tells people appropriately. You see, that telling process doesn't give people the opportunity to make sense of, do I need to change or not? And the truth is that all of us are highly complex beings. Not only is the system out there complex, but the system in here is extremely complex too. So we're all carrying around like a universe within our heads. Think of this universe comprising the voice of your mum and dad, your siblings, your favourite teacher, someone who said something dreadful to you in a particular role at work sometime. All of those things are at play for all of us. And certainly as a facilitator of people in large groups at times, that complexity can be hugely challenging. And maybe you experience this too. But that complexity is also the source of a complexity of responses to the complexity of the challenge that surrounds us, the complexity of the challenge that is sustainability. It's not actually sustainability, I mean by it. It's not actually just a simple scientific challenge. There is actually the challenge of helping people to make sense of what's going on and respond differently accordingly. So the top-down solution tends to generate silver bullets. In amongst all of that complexity of the challenge, we tend to generate silver bullet solutions that we can deliver in certain ways. And I would ask you to reflect upon how effective that's been. 50 years later, after we've realised that we need to respond to this challenge, 50 years after The Limits of Growth was first published, we are still struggling to really make a dent in this challenge. So how can we create a range of solutions that actually match the complexity of the challenge? That's what I've been thinking about for a long time now. So I want to take us now to that third hold-on, to the cultural hold-on for a minute, and we'll come back to that structural hold-on in due course. So culture is something that's beginning to come into people's consciousness now within organisations. We're much more aware that there is a thing that's called culture, but it's actually not a thing. We have a tendency in our Western culture to think of things like culture, processes like culture, and we label them with a noun and we think it's a thing. But it's not a thing. It's actually an ongoing process, a flux of life, if you like. Our Western culture, for example, is full of assumptions and, let me go back a step. What is culture? Think of it as a piece of fabric woven with unconscious assumptions that have developed over time in response to values that have stood the test of time. I'm wondering how that fits with your understanding of what culture is. There's no levers to pull. It's not a thing, it's a process. It's a way of people interacting with each other. And it has a legacy. It goes way back in time. What we're experiencing now has a legacy that extends way back in time. And part of the legacy that we have in our Western culture is a colonialist mindset, a colonialist activity in the past, patriarchy in the past that we're struggling with now in the present moment, and also a very mechanistic worldview, a very scientific worldview, the home of Newton, when he helped develop the scientific process. It's a worldview that sees direct cause and effect. Do this, get that. It's a worldview that sees not only direct cause and effect, but a consistent and predictable cause and effect. And that means that we've developed a worldview that we think we can control things, when in fact we can't. It's a worldview that breaks things down to its smallest parts for us to understand how the whole operates. So go back to my story about all of that individual coaching within the DSTO and it not producing the cultural effect. The assumption underpinning that activity is that all of that individual coaching, that part plus that part, that plus that part, will actually generate the whole. But it doesn't. There's so much more than just that part and that part and that part. As Rumi said, you think that you understand two because you understand one and one equals two. But first you must understand and. So culture is like that too. And we have a culture that is underpinned by these assumptions. And that Western culture permeates the way we run our organisations as well. And it means that we've got organisations that have control at the centre of their operations. There's a fantastic book that I've been reading just lately by Aaron Dignan, Brave New Work, and he uses this fantastic contrast. He sets up a story around Control Inc. and another one around Emergence Inc. And that's really what I'm pointing to here, that unintentionally, unconsciously, most of our organisations are based around top-down control. And that culture generates structures that I think are a blind spot and are getting in our way. The possibility of moving to an emergency, a different worldview, a different paradigm, and embedding that into our culture is that this living systems paradigm is one where we recognise the interdependence between everything. It is one where we recognise that actually my well-being depends upon your well-being. And so me helping to care for you means that I'm caring for myself as well. This is the mindset of stewardship. And this is the mindset that we can actually place at the heart of our organisations and have our organisations benefit a great deal as well. It offers the opportunity within the irreducible uncertainty that all of that emergence and interdependence creates, but it offers the possibility of actually liberating whole people, of recognising that they have something to contribute and that they can contribute to the complexity of the solutions that are needed to actually meet the complexity of the challenge. So shifting the way we perceive the world is a possible, I think that's at the heart of the sustainability challenge. And my work in my PhD explored how we might do that in an organisational setting. And it's so great to see some of my co-researchers on the call here today. As we explored how we could use emergent change processes to catalyse that change, that transformation within an organisation. And we saw a glimmer of it for a few years and it was a fantastic experiment. The third piece that I want to share with you today is the structural piece, the structural hold-on. And to recognise that I'm coming to it last because it actually flows out of the cultural assumptions that we have about the way things work. But it's not just the infrastructure that I encountered in the way the road system and the public transport is set up around my house. That's part of it. But I think we've had a large blind spot, actually, around the fact that our very organisations and institutions are a part of this structure as well. And that if we want to change the effects that we have in the world, maybe we need to look at the way we are structuring our organisations, are structuring our work, and are going about solving our problems. Maybe we need to bring a new way of thinking to that, that we've had a blind spot thinking that we can change things out there using exactly the same tools and structures and processes that actually created the problem out there. I think that's a huge opportunity to start thinking about how do we restructure things, how do we create new processes to analyse the challenges, how do we create new ways of running initiatives rather than projects, thinking about experiments rather than answers. These are all part of the change in the structure that I think is a possibility at that point in time. The structure of our organisations, as Aaron pointed out, traditionally in the hierarchy is one of power over people. Not that it's necessarily done with ill intent. It can be very benevolent, but nevertheless it is power over, and there's a lot of fear that's generated consciously and unconsciously in that sort of structure. How do we move from that sort of structure to a more embracing, inclusive, power with type of structure? And of course, there's a number of people that are exploring different ways of doing that, different governance structures to do that within organisations. There was the Teal organisation a few years ago, there's Holacracy, there's a number of things that we can already benefit from the thinking of that's out there in the world already. We don't have to invent this from scratch. There's things we can start to draw in. But how do we manoeuvre that within an organisation? Because there are existing power structures and there are people that will feel that they're losing or giving things up. So how do we operate politically? And I think this is one of our challenges as well. So in a moment, I'm going to give you a tick to write down some thoughts that might be emerging for you. But just in closing this little section, I would like to share with you a story from an emerging client. And I hope this organisation becomes a client in the very near future. It's actually part of a tertiary education institution and with an amazing leadership, because they are recognising a systemic perspective, whether they are aware of it or not. They train nurses, and they recognise that in the future their nurses need to be able to operate differently. They need to be able to work across disciplines. They need to emerge from their training being inclined and able and equipped to work interdisciplinarily. Is that a word? Interdisciplinarily? It's a big word. Anyway, across all of those disciplines. And what they're recognising is that they need to deliver a strategic plan to the powers that be within their institution. And they need to actually influence the personal mindsets of everyone that's teaching and managing within that school at the moment. And so we're constructing a strategic planning process, an emergent strategic process to work with people so that they're all engaged. This is power with, right? All engaged in the process, and that they are clear and have created a common and shared vision together that they can connect to emotionally and that makes sense to them. So that's the personal part of the whole on. They are also recognising that as this comes together, there is a new culture that needs to emerge, because not if you want students to end up interdisciplinarily inclined at the end, then you've got to do that on the way through, and that's not the way the school's structured at the moment. So they're recognising that there's a new culture, a new way of understanding the world, and a new way of working together as staff that needs to be inculcated too. And to support that, they have garnered the funds to develop an entire new building over the next 5 years that actually reflects the outcomes that they're looking for and reflects the assumptions that will be embedded into the culture in the future, so that they can work together in ways in this building that actually will support the outcomes that they're trying to generate. So that's one of the structural things as well. The very strategic planning process is a structural thing as well. So I think it's possible, and we're already seeing it happen, and I'm wondering what's coming up for you. And if you'd just like to take a few moments to jot down a few thoughts, I'll have a look through the chat box as you're doing that, and I'll find any questions that I can answer in the next couple of minutes before we talk a little bit about how you might generate that vision. So moving on, I wanted to leave you with a couple of thoughts, just touching back to the question that we originally asked. So if this change is so right, and we know that it is, why is it so hard? Well, maybe the answer to that is that because we've perceived change as very one-dimensional. We've perceived it as me telling you what needs to be done. And there is so much more going on at the same time. So change actually needs to be multidimensional. It is multidimensional, in fact, whether we're aware of it or not. So if we can become more aware of the multidimensional facets of change and be aware of the ways we need to, like the teachers, like the staff in the medical school, be aware of how we need to be thinking through, not controlling, but engaging with the different elements of change, engaging with the different elements of the system and perceiving it differently. This doesn't necessarily have to be that hard. It can be a challenging process because we're dealing with all of that complexity of every individual. But we can take advantage of that. That's going to work in our favour if we engage with it differently. So one of the things that I've been, as many of the people on this call will recognise, banging on about for years now, has been the opportunity of generating co-created shared visions. Not at the level of a predetermined outcome, because in a complex world, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And certainly COVID's already taught us that, hasn't it? We don't know. It takes some humility to be able to say that. And we are all a part of the system, the systems. And so we do have influence. So one of the ways I've been working with people, and if you'd like to look at a couple of examples, one would be the people at Gumaraka. It's a small town up in the Adelaide Hills. Some years ago, I joined a local group of activists, not with them, but they invited me along to talk with them about how they could bring order to what they were doing and also coherence and also produce something that would last over time. So we went through a process of generating a co-created shared vision at the level of values. We asked the question, how do you really want to experience your main street? Because that's what they were concerned about, their main street in Gumaraka. And we asked, how do we want to experience it? How do we want other people to experience it? And they generated a vision of their for their main street at the level of values. And I will never forget one of the people coming up to me at the end of that workshop, because we talked about values and how the initiatives need to express all of the values at the same time, not just one value now and again. That's a reductionist way of thinking about it. But an integrated way of thinking about it is expressing all of those values at the same time. And he said, so we don't need to argue about the nature of the art anymore, whether we actually like it or not. The important thing about the art or the sculptures that may go along the street is that other people are curious about them and they just come and they linger and they look whether they like it or not. And I said, you've got it. This is a way of actually bringing people together. We don't have to argue about the concrete form anymore. We can be united in the experience that we want. This is a way of bringing order and coherence instead of control. We don't have to control to get the outcomes, but we need something that gives order and coherence, and a co-created shared vision can supply that order and coherence. And here's the kicker, and that multitude of approaches that actually produces a complexity to meet the complexity of the challenge. It's just sitting there waiting for us to tackle. And it doesn't mean that your strategic approaches within your organisation don't have value. They do. They are one of the approaches. They are a part of that complexity. But there is a whole range of other complexity that you can bring to this too. So if you think of your vision at the centre, then the experiments that each person or each group might create in response to that shared vision, and you're going to create that together. So it's not that you don't have input into it. That vision will create a number of experiments coming out of it, and we will see what works to bring this vision into being. So we usually think about a vision as a kind of an endpoint over here, trying to get it right on the screen. Over here, and we think of ourselves as here now, and we're going to align everyone exactly in the right stepping order, and we're going to follow the steps over to this vision in a nice, perfect little straight line. It doesn't work like that, does it? That's the mechanistic approach to the world, but it actually doesn't work like that. You know how messy that can get. I used to write strategic plans. I know how messy that can get. The world doesn't work like that, actually. And so I'm reminded of the words of Gregory Bateson, that the major challenges in the world are actually a result of the difference between the way the world really works and the way we think it works. So I think I'd like to leave those thoughts there for a moment and suggest that our work might be more around helping people to recognise the ways in which the world really works and translate that into how we work within our organisations, and particularly become more aware of perhaps that blind spot around culture and structure. Change isn't just about telling people what to do, and that misses the mark in terms of the complexity of the challenge. Maybe if we can liberate more change, we'll actually meet the complexity of the challenge more effectively. I certainly don't think I don't think it can do any harm. When I started my PhD research, where we explored emergent change, I remember talking to the CEO, he's an absolutely lovely man, and I was seeking his permission to do this. And he said, well, I don't know if you're going to do any good, Josie, but you're certainly not going to do any harm, so go for it. And he gave me permission. I think that's the approach to take. If you're not convinced, I am convinced. I'm really convicted that this is the way forward. But if you're not convinced, think of it as an experiment that can't do any harm, and it might do some good. So it's worth having a play with. Where could you play with it? Perhaps just in your team, perhaps somewhere localised within your organisation. To support you in that, I've created a new service called Sustainability Sounding Board. And it's a mentoring and coaching service. It's mentoring because you get the benefit of my 20-odd years of experimenting myself and developing my own ability to perceive systemically. It does take practice and awareness, but that's not to say that it's not already within you. It is. This program is 6 months, either individual or group, so two different formats, individual or group mentoring and coaching process with me. Over 6 months, supported by some videos, lots of online exercises and assessment tools, things like that for you to work through as well. And I would encourage you, if you accept my invitation to join me, to bring a real challenge along with you to these sessions too, and we can actually work through that challenge together and help you make progress on it. I think that the opportunity here on a broader scale is really to help us to move from that sort of individual, authoritative, expert-based form of leadership into a genuine collective movement type of leadership. Move from sort of individual pushing to collective pulling. And you'll find that you don't have to put as much energy in. It'll be a different type of energy. And my experience is there's usually energy being generated in the room that I'm benefiting from all of the time. This different way of leading then opens up the opportunity of engaging with people in different ways. So rather than persuading or driving people, we're opening up the opportunity of engaging, sense-making, producing more ideas, having them ordered and coherent because of that shared vision. So don't go thinking chaos. I don't want you to think that. There is order and there is coherence. It's just different to what we're used to. And actually mobilising a movement within your organisation. And this can extend then beyond out into the sector and the industries in which you work. You've got a unique role to play there, depending upon your very position, the strengths of your organisation, your personal strengths. What is the unique role that you can play within that sector and industry? So your impact can move from sort of a limited persuasion or within the business as usual paradigm to actually developing higher ambitions, liberating more ambitions within people and liberating staff, enabling more meaningful work, enabling growth, development, strengths, enabling learning and meaning. And you will find that productivity goes up, and you will find that the number of ideas coming forth goes up. And they don't have to be squashed. They just need to be experimented with to find out whether they work or not. And if people don't have the energy for doing something, then it won't happen. And that's the way living systems work. Here's a possibility of a new way of actually reshaping your entire industries with more productivity and more possibilities. So I'd love you to consider joining me. If you are tempted, please set up a discovery session with me over the next couple of days or the next week or so, and we can explore together whether this this program might be for you. My commitment to sustainability practitioners over the next 7.5 years has been to actually step forward and offer in any way that will meet your needs what I've learned over the last 15 years about the human dimension of sustainability. So please be in contact with me if you can think of other ways that I can support you as you bring your technical and people expertise to the fore over the next 7.5 years too. We've got a lot of work to do, right? So I want to leave you with three ideas. I know some of you might have to leave this call relatively soon. Here's some things that you can do right now. First of all, compassionately ask yourself, how could I be more aspirational? How could I imagine that I could have even greater influence than I'm currently having? And I emphasise the compassionately there because I am somewhat aware of the amount of energy and thought and passion that already goes into your work. So this is not about whipping yourself. But I think there is an opportunity to be more aspirational around some of those blind spots. And that links to the second thing. How can you raise your awareness around those potential blind spots that I might have flagged today? Are the structural and the cultural elements being attended to? And how would this change the influence, the impact of what you're doing? And thirdly, learn more about the paradigm of complexity or living systems if you haven't already. And you might like to follow the link in the chat box that James is just popping in there now, so that you can download some chapters of my book, Big Little Shifts. It's for practitioners of complexity. So you might like to download that. And if you liked it, you might even like to buy the book. There's a thought. So we've got a few minutes left. So if you have to leave now, please feel free. And it's been, I want to thank you for coming along. And, you know, there's an opportunity cost in attending something like this. So I'm highly respectful of that. Thank you for being here. And if you've got time to stay and chat, I'd love to generate a space where we can just talk together. Maybe you've got questions that I've got answers to, but maybe you've got questions that other people have got answers to. And we just have a chat for the next 15 minutes or so. And so I'm wondering, what have my thoughts provoked in you? What are you thinking now?